Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 28 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the 8th of season 3. This one is all about Daimon the First of Anarquist, the Restoration King. King Daimon the First was crowned on the first day of the year 429, after the bloody Battle of Tegemain Pass, where he led an allied army against an overwhelmingly larger Anarquistian army, before finally besting and killing Queen Keska, thus ending the period of Anarquistian history known as the Nightmare Years, and restoring the legitimate dynastic line. Not a bad CV, right? But that's only the beginning. Let's dive deep. The Overview. Daimon was born in the year 389 in the far northern realm of Brel, where his grandfather Ephraim Anarquist had fled when Grappina the Cruel killed his father, King Haldan, and usurped the throne of Anarquist in the year 339. If you remember episode 10 of season 2, I told how all of King Haldan I's children, Celtimer, Ephraim and Abelard, were presumed to have been murdered by Queen Grappina on her way to seizing the throne. As it turns out, this wasn't the case. Ephraim, Haldan's second child, managed to escape and make his way to Brel, where the family established themselves, safely out of the reach of now Queen Grappina. The family had managed to bring some valuables with them, despite their hasty flight, including some very rare and valuable scales. Soon they were established in trade and in the lower governing circles, mostly municipal duties in the capital city, Egburn, where their careful financial management was appreciated. Daimon's father, Omir, was elected onto the ruling major council and eventually to the position of chief arbiter, the most powerful post in this land. His son, Daimon, chose not to follow in his father's footsteps and enter governance, but he went into the military, an officer's commission being purchased by his father. He rose through the ranks swiftly, showing outstanding leadership qualities and a flair for cunning tactics on the battlefield. He had many chances to display these talents, as Brel was subject to many raids from fierce and predatory fleets from the large tropical island of Vesbesili to the north. As detailed in our last episode, when Queen Keska of Anarquist conquered the tiny realm of Gesh, not far from the northern borders of Anarquist, and then announced a campaign of conquest with the avowed aim of subjugating the entire continent, Daimon Anarquist was one of the first to understand what this meant. Thanks to his foresight and outstanding personal qualities, he rallied a number of other realms and formed an alliance that resisted and then defeated Queen Keska and her overwhelmingly larger force in late 428, after which Daimon Anarquist was hailed as the rightful king of Anarquist. He ruled wisely, foregoing vengeance and reprisal, pardoning many and punishing only a few. King Daimon I died peacefully in the spring of the year 441. He was succeeded by his oldest son Blemon, who took the name Daimon when he came to the throne in honour of his father, the man who restored the Anarquist line. Reign highlights. Queen Keska, the war for the continent, and the end of the Nightmare Years. Come the time, comes the individual, and this was certainly true in these most nightmarish of the Nightmare Years. Brel was a coastal realm in the steamy, tropical far north. Hitherto, it had mostly been known for its fishing, shipbuilding and rope-making industries, as well as its excellent leatherworking, using the hides of several larger species of reptile found there, dryland and waterside. But a young man had risen to command its small but well-respected army, and Daimon Anarquist had an impeccable Anarquistian pedigree. If you remember, the throne of Anaquist had been usurped by Gripenny the Cruel in the year 339. She was the subject of episode 2 of this season, when I told about how, after the death of King Haldan, all his children, Saltimer, Ephraim and Abelard, were presumed to have been murdered by Queen Gripenna on her way to seizing the throne. As it happens, this wasn't the case. Ephraim, Daimon's second child, managed to escape and make his way to Brel, where he was safe. In exile, he made a fortune, married and had children, and the eldest was Daimon, who rose to command Brel's army. It was this Daimon Anaquist who successfully defended Brel from an attack by the Anaquistian navy in 393. While this was probably more of an expeditionary force, a trial run if you like, it was the first time that any Anaquistian attempt had been repelled. It was greeted with much joy in Brel, naturally, but as word filtered out, it was noted by all the other realms in the world below the war in the heavens. A delegation from Framen, the realm on the other side of the Great Northern Gulf, was sent to Brel to negotiate an alliance. At first, the merchants and traders in Brel, the most powerful citizens in this city-state, were appalled at the notion of an alliance. They thought that a continued policy of distant neutrality would keep Brel safe. They claimed that the recent attack from Anaquist must have been a mistake, truly meant for Framen or Benthia to the southwest. They argued that an alliance of any sort would simply provoke Anaquist and make it more bellicose, not less. But Daimon Anaquist's success and his outstanding personal qualities had gathered him many supporters. After Daimon made a stirring speech to the major council, advising that tyrants and bullies must be resisted, all naysayers on the major council were voted out and embarrassed. An alliance was negotiated with Framen, and soon other realms were sending diplomats to discuss the possibilities of a wider alliance. In this period, at least 3 assassination attempts were made on the life of Daimon Anaquist. He personally dispatched 2 of them, while his bodyguard saw to the 3rd. Clearly, Queen Keska was concerned about this man, and not just because the alliance against Anaquist was growing, but because he had a legitimate claim to the throne, and a claim that was arguably much better than Keska, the current incumbent. Daimon Anaquist called a meeting of all the realms that wished to resist Anaquistian aggression, the famous Lashmine Conference of early 397, named after the capital city of Kildare, where it was held. Eager representatives came from those realms closest to Anaquist, such as Honf and Beren, but others were present as well, even representatives from faraway Tras on the west coast. It was resolved to assemble a consolidated army, and that Daimon Anaquist would be the supreme commander. It was an alliance of desperation, really. After the destruction of Arenthia in late 396, it had become clear that Anaquist could easily pick off the realms one by one, and the only hope was to unite. Failure to confront Anaquist successfully would certainly doom every realm in the world below the war in the heavens. It wasn't unexpected that the Alliance army was subject to petty rivalries and ambitious commanders who thought they knew best, but Daimon Anaquist proved himself to be an outstanding leader. Troops travelled from every realm to Kildare, where Daimon had established the Alliance army headquarters and camp. More than 20,000 soldiers combined to make the force that was to take on the Anaquistians, and the sight of so many assembled had some calling out for an immediate attack. Daimon, however, had an extensive spy network, and he knew that the entire Anaquistian army, if united, numbered well over 50,000 soldiers. If the Allied army was to be successful, it was going to be through a combination of strategy and tactics. But before that, he needed to train this disparate band of diverse soldiery and make them fitter, faster, and more adaptable than the legendary Anaquistian troops. He also wanted his soldiers equipped with the best weapons, from the frontline commanders right down to the lowliest foot slogger. To do this would take time, and with Queen Keska on the march, time was in short supply. For details on how Daimon managed to turn a raft of suspicious, disparate national armies into a highly organised and cohesive fighting force ready to face overwhelming odds, I've turned to O.L. Montgomery's recent book, The Military Genius of Daimon Anarchist. Montgomery's admiration for Daimon Anarchist can't be disguised, and what could have been a dry list of achievements in administration and militaria is instead an energetic and vigorous work, especially when it comes to describing battles where Montgomery switches between useful overviews and gritty on-the-ground accounts. According to Montgomery, who ploughed through primary sources including a stash of quartermaster's records, which have recently been found in the ruins of Ulm, of all places, Daimon Anarchist defied convention of the time, and once the alliance was sealed and he was appointed supreme commander, he immediately delegated powers to a number of others who he had been sizing up for some time. This caused a stir, as supreme commanders were pretty much expected to take charge and make all decisions themselves in a high-handed manner. That's what being the boss of an army meant. Instead, the alliance found that they had someone who set principles and parameters, then left the trusted underlings to whip their battalions into the sort of order needed, an order that would be consistent across the whole army. Revolutionary it was, as was Daimon's similar delegation when it came to supply and armaments. He set the standards and quality required, appointed capable people, then left them to it. This isn't to say that his underlings were unmonitored. A number who were proving that they weren't up to the job were quickly removed and replaced, but so smoothly that little progress was lost. One more significant point about Daimon Anarchist's leadership. He wouldn't have anything to do with nepotism. His sons were in their early 20s at this time, and both had distinguished themselves in the army of Brel, particularly in fighting off that scouting attack by the Anarchistian Navy in early 397. Daimon astonished prominent figures in the alliance by not appointing his sons to command positions in the alliance army. Once these important appointments were made and deadlines set, Daimon Anarchist chiefly concerned himself with strategy. How was the allied army going to fare against the huge Anarchistian force? Even if they were well-drilled, well-equipped and well-supplied, the odds were against them. Understanding that much of military strategy came down to anticipating the movements of the foe, while Queen Kesca's army was rampaging through Arenthia, Daimon Anarchist was sure that Honf, to Arenthia's immediate north, was the next target. He understood that clandestine activities and what we'd call psyops, or psychological operations today, were as important as head-to-head clashes. And he had long ago sent spies into Anarchist to infiltrate the army, to get close to Queen Kesca's advisers and decision-makers. After the raising of Arenthia by Kesca's troops, the spies' clear aim was to steer the Anarchistian army toward Inner Honf, on the other side of the transcontinental mountain range, rather than its coastal cousin state of Honf. If this could be achieved, Daimon Anarchist was sure that he could use some distinctive features of the terrain to deploy his forces in a way that would negate the Anarchistian army's greater numbers. Some luck was on the side of the Allied army, as the weather made the Anarchistians' initial march north very difficult, with some losses and a definite drop in morale. Upon reaching the southern border of Honf, it became clear that the army was veering west, with Inner Honf as its target. Whether his spies and agents were successful, or whether it was some whim of Queen Kesca, Daimon Anarchist made the most of it, his daring coming to the fore. He wasn't afraid to split his smaller force into even smaller contingents. The Battle of Tegermain Pass. If you want a fuller description of the Battle of Tegermain Pass, that probably means you missed the last episode, where I go into detail, so pop back and have a listen. In short, Daimon divided his army into two parts. Setting off from Kildare, one part crossed the mountains and hurried south, and then climbed and deployed themselves in the heights on either side of the pass. They dug in and with manic speed and much effort stockpiled tons of rock, especially around where the pass opened out onto the way to Inner Honf. A clever system of flag signals was put in place so that this team could unleash an avalanche of boulders to block the pass just before the Anarquistian army reached the end of the pass. Its way blocked, the army would have no choice but to return the way it had come. Marshalling such a large horde to reverse its way in good order was challenging to say the least, and that was without the barrage of rocks and arrows and sling bullets that was unleashed thanks to another flag signal. 12 miles, more or less, was the Tegemain Pass, and for the Anarquistian army it was 12 miles of hell. There were no tales of heroism or great bravery to come from this retreat, for the Anarquistians had no way of coming to grips with their foe, the sides of the defile being sheer and immensely high. A fraction of the force made its way to the entrance to the pass, only to face the other part of the Alliance army, with Daimon and his two sons, Blemon and Hotch, at its head. Eventually, Daimon met Keska in single combat and slew her after a mighty struggle. At this, of course, the Anarquistian army wavered, but the day would not have been won if it hadn't been for messengers who had ridden at speed from the coast to report that the mighty Anarquistian navy had been routed. This is more cleverness from Daimon. You see, the Anarquistian navy had set off from the port city that had once been Arenth, the capital of Arenthia, the realm that had been raised in Keska's march northwards. The Anarquistian navy was huge, with many large warships, a fleet vast enough to sail into Lashmeen, the capital of Kildare, and take it. This, of course, had been much on Daimon's mind. It would have been futile if he could defeat the Anarquistian army, only for the Anarquistian navy to smash nations as they made their way north. Any navy he could put together from his alliance partners would be pitifully small, and so once again he showed his unconventional thinking. While he was making preparations for the great trap and ambush at the Tegemain Pass, he was also recruiting fisher folk from up and down the coast, particularly those who had once lived in Arenthia, the realm conquered by Queen Keska and completely destroyed. Daimon's hope was that the small and swift craft would have an advantage over huge and lumbering vessels. In addition, Daimon knew of places where a black tarry substance oozed from the ground in Brel. It had many uses, from sealing roofs to making sure buckets were waterproof, but Daimon was more interested in its flammability as well as its stickiness. A hasty enterprise was established packing ceramic flasks with this substance, stoppering them with cloth. With the skippers of the fishing boats knowing the coastal waters well, they advised Daimon that the best place for them to lie in wait was Cape Rosamuch, about halfway between Arenthia and Honf, a place of tricksy winds, awkward reefs, and deceptive sandbars. A combination of manoeuvrability, local knowledge, favourable weather, and flaming missiles managed to turn the mighty Anarquistian navy. And when the small fleet that was the Alliance Navy bore down on the survivors, it turned about and scudded south in disgrace. Of course, some of the astonishing bravery of the fisher folk could well have been due to their desire for revenge, for the bloodthirsty pillaging of their villages, so the Anarquistians reaped what they'd sowed. Daimon immediately proclaimed, after these victories, that anyone who had been enslaved by Queen Keska was now free. Nearly all the Arenthians who'd been dragged to Anarquist after their realm had been invaded and conquered took their leave and trudged back to their homeland, but almost all of them returned and begged to be allowed to stay once they saw the devastation that had been wrought on their land. Daimon granted a large part of the southwest of Anarquist to these people as long as they were happy to become loyal subjects. They all gratefully agreed. Speaking of rewards, Daimon rewarded the fisher folk who had been crucial in the victory. He sent his army engineers and sappers to rebuild the fishing towns that Queen Keska's army had razed, and he sent gold to be distributed among the captains. He also proclaimed that no seafood other than that caught by the mid-coast fisher folk would be served at his royal table as long as he was king. Coronation. Daimon was hailed as a king on the battlefield, but the true coronation took place a week later, in the first weekend of the new year 329. This not only marked the defeat of Queen Kheska, it marked the end of her line and the end of the nightmare years. Daimon's reign was the restoration of the true Anaquistian dynasty and a revival of all that was good about the realm. Daimon's speech after his coronation resounds down through the ages and is often remembered when times are parlous. After the darkest days, Anaquist will rise again and light will be abroad for one and all. We'll all shine on like the moon and the stars and the sun. Daring as he was as a warrior, Daimon was thoughtful and almost cautious as a ruler. An early speech made it clear he wasn't going to rush in and make changes holus bolus. He wanted to take stock first, then act, after he'd considered matters of the realm thoroughly. He was commended for this, except in one area. A popular uprising in the early weeks of his reign saw the people, most of them ex-slaves, tearing down any monument that Kheska or her immediate forebears had erected. The move to obliterate the rulers who had brought about the nightmare years was an expression, an outpouring of relief in some ways, and Daimon soon saw it for what it was. After consulting his advisory council, he declared an official expunging of anything to do with the rulers of the nightmare years. Anyone could remove any inscription, statue, or dedication mentioning the names of these terrible monarchs with the complete endorsement of the authorities. By the end of the year, much of the capital city looked like it had before Agrippina the Cruel seized power, apart from many large mounds of rubble, which soon became building materials for a new phase of urban development in the city. The Library of Souls. King Daimon greatly extended and funded the library, which had been a rather small and overlooked building within the walls of the stronghold. It had become run down and somewhat neglected, to tell the truth. The new library, immediately dubbed the Library of Souls, was extensive, and the entire system of organising texts was revolutionised to allow easier access to what was already a large collection. A special wing was included for the Cylinders of the Monarchs. These cylinders, containing a distillation of the memories and experiences of many monarchs, the Nightmare Years rulers were a notable absence, had, until this point, been stored in scattered locations throughout the royal palace. Now they were organised and kept both securely and reverently, waiting for each member of the royal family to reach the age of choosing. At the same time, Daimon formalised the cylinder ceremony, naming it the Ceremony of Imparting, and making it a sacred custom instead of a personal preference, as it had been up until then. His view was that all members of the royal family needed to demonstrate wisdom, and the lesson learned by ancestors was helpful in attaining this. Thereafter, all members of the royal family undertook the Ceremony of Imparting, whereupon reaching the age of 16, they chose a cylinder containing a distillation of the memories and experiences of a forebear and assimilated them for the lessons they contained. Of course, there were a few notable exceptions that we'll come across as we continue our exploration of Anaquistian history. Foreign relations. King Daimon was keen to resume regular relations with every other nation across the continent. Those who joined the Alliance army were convinced that Anaquist was no longer ruled by fiends, and diplomacy and trade quickly resumed. The few realms that hadn't joined the Alliance, notably Phoenicia in the far west and Jalox to the south, were wary but soon came on board when the riches that went with trade with Anaquist, scales and otherworldly material in particular, was abroad again. Soon the continent had a peace that had been unknown for decades, and prosperity ensued. Daimon was also careful to purge and reform the army, reducing it in size as well. He took the opportunity to modernise its command structure and its logistics, making it a smaller, more efficient force, with a focus on defence and peacekeeping, rather than fulfilling any expansionist aims of its monarch. Personal life. Daimon Aniquis, later Daimon I, married Jesline Hud, the oldest daughter of a prominent Brelian merchant in 385. It was a happy marriage and a prosperous one, as Jesline continued managing her father's very successful importing and exporting firm. And after he died, she took it over completely. She died, giving birth to their second son, Hotch, and Daimon was prostrate with grief, so much so that a number of his friends thought he'd never recover. He did, but he never looked at another woman again. When he ascended to the throne, he commissioned a small but exquisitely carved memorial in a courtyard garden in the royal palace, a garden thereafter known as Jesline's Garden, and he tended it himself, with a little help from the palace gardeners. He chose Blemon as his successor once the younger son, Hotch, had undertaken his ceremony of imparting. While impressed that both had chosen to learn from the cylinder of Eucantha Aniquis, the founder of the dynasty, after fighting alongside both in skirmishes and repelling the Aniquistian navy, he judged that Blemon was more suited as a leader and Hotch as a solid, dependable second in command, and so it proved. In his later years, perhaps because of his solitary private life, King Daimon was a solemn figure, even slightly aloof. A wise and fair ruler, he had the love of his people, and there was great lamentation from all, from aristocrat to common folk, when he died. In many ways, he was a reluctant monarch, and over the 2,000 years of Aniquistian history, it's interesting how often the more reluctant monarchs become the best rulers. The ambitious, the grasping, the conniving tend to fall foul of their own ambition. Several statues and busts survive of Daimon I. He was a tall and imposing figure, muscular and with broad shoulders, a fine figure for a warrior. He is always depicted with a pointed beard, a Brelian fashion of the time, soon followed by many men in Aniquis. Coins customarily show him as almost frowning, a severe countenance at odds with the gentle and thoughtful reputation he had once he became king. Daimon I died in the spring of the year 441 while meditating in Jesline's garden, having updated his cylinder in the Library of Souls only a few days earlier. Initially, he'd been reluctant to start a cylinder at all and needed to be persuaded by the chief librarian and most of his advisory council. He was also reluctant to record an entry in the annals, but acceded when pressed. His entry is one of the more self-effacing among the self-tributes there, modesty not being a trait common in the Aniquis dynasty. King Daimon's body was found by a young gardener, who rarely had to buy a drink for herself for the rest of her life as she shared the story, particularly the detail about the smile on the old monarch's face, a smile that had been a stranger for some years. And that's all for King Daimon I, which in some ways is a misleading title because he spent most of his life as just plain Daimon Aniquis, not a king at all. But he is remembered in Aniquis to this day as one of the good monarchs, and the one who ended the horror that was the Nightmare Years. And that's it for episode 28 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. Coming up next, King Daimon II. Until then, farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.